Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the South African National Editors Forum slams the KZN police chief over what it terms a chilling attack on press freedom. Action SA accuses government of immigration flip-flops on Zimbabwean permits, and Home Affairs responds, saying the extension is pending consultation. And South Africa's poor pay the price as the data divide deepens. It's Monday, the 13th of October. The South African National Editors Forum has hit back at the KwaZulu-Natal Police Commissioner, Lieutenant General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi, after he called for counter-intelligence probes into media houses and heavy penalties for journalists. The forum says it's a chilling attack on press freedom. I want to explore this in a little more detail with Katie Kadapotis from SANEF. Katie, welcome to you. Thank you very much for talking to me. What is SANEF's main concern about the Commissioner's comments?
Thanks, Jeremy. SANEF's main concern here is that Lieutenant General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi really, we believe, has overstepped here by calling for journalists who make mistakes to be imprisoned, for asking for these high-level security probes into journalists, for state security to investigate journalists. We really believe that this would have a very, very chilling effect on media freedom. Having said that, though, Jeremy, we're also very much of the view that if General Mkhwanazi has evidence about wrongdoing in the media fraternity, he's got to bring that evidence forward. What we saw last week in Parliament wasn't the evidence. We're not certain if he is not disclosing it for various reasons, but we are saying to him, he's got to make that evidence available to us.
How dangerous is it, Katie, when this kind of language comes from a top police official?
It's very, very dangerous. You know, criminalizing journalism and criminalizing journalists, especially when we know that for the most part, our main priority is really trying to uncover the truth. We believe that this is dangerous because, you know, we suddenly go back to dark eras, not in our country, but in the world where we do see journalists being imprisoned. And that is not where we want to go. You know, we believe, Jeremy, that self-regulation is the way to go. We don't believe in journalists having licenses and having to be licensed by certain bodies who oversee them. And we do really, really want General Mkhwanazi to rethink what he's saying about journalists. Again, and let me repeat, if he does have specific information, it's so important because, you know, Jeremy, I can't sit here and blindly defend all my media colleagues, and SANEF can't do that either. So if there is cause for concern in some newsrooms in this country, we've got to have those details.
Katie, he claims that national security is at stake. Where's the line in 2025, do you think, between security and censorship?
It is a fine line, and we've got to be careful not to cross it. So we saw, Jeremy, many years ago, you know, we had that proposed Protection of State Information Bill, which really threatened, again, to throw journalists in jail if information was wrong. And in terms of national and state security, sure, we believe that the security of the Republic must always be top of mind. But you can't censor journalists to do that, because if it were not for journalists breaking these stories, if it were not for the reports that we're seeing, so much of what we saw just last week play out in our media would not be happening. And so there is a very fine line, and we've got to be careful not to censor journalists in South Africa. It would be very, very dangerous.
Okay, did you think it's becoming more difficult, not only in South Africa, but perhaps even globally, to balance media freedom with responsible reporting on sensitive matters?
It's such a good question, Jeremy, and you And you're right to ask it. I think we have a responsibility as journalists to expose wrongdoings and hold a mirror to our society. There is some information that in that process of our reporting may be sensitive, but there are ways of getting around that. And I really believe if editors and if journalists, when they're sitting around those diary tables and, you know, we're having our diary meetings, if we're discussing this in a way that is about our craft and about the story, I think we will get that balance right. And of course, the responsibility is also on us. And we've got to be very, very mindful that in this day and age, particularly with elections coming up, journalists are often being used, and people use journalists to push their own agendas. This is where training needs to come in. This is where we need to say to our teams of reporters, we've got to be very, very conscious. Our principles and our ethics of journalism, we can never forget those, so that we don't find ourselves on the wrong end of the story here and ending up becoming the story ourselves. That's the last thing we'd ever want.
Katie, is there a worry, I wonder, that remarks like this may be intimidating smaller or independent newsrooms, maybe more than some of the big established media houses?
I think that's always a worry, particularly younger and greener journalists. You know, our media fraternity needs to bring in good journalists. And I worry that something like this will make younger journalists specifically kind of think, ooh, what are we doing? If I get something wrong, am I going to end up in jail? So it does have that worrying effect. I think the more established media houses, especially ones with lawyers on retainer, can kind of, you know, push these threats back, and so we should. And of course, this is also the role of SANEF to come in and say, where we do believe that there is a threat against media and journalists, either individuals or as a collective, where we do have to sit up and say, no, we can't accept this. Either come forward with solid information that will allow us or the media houses themselves to act, but we think it is reckless to be saying things in an ad hoc committee meeting there in Parliament, where we're basically calling for the criminalisation of journalism.
So apropos this particular issue then, what is SANEF doing?
So our call is an open call to say, please make sure that you come forward. I think we're also having discussions now, Jeremy, about approaching senior officials to go, well, what information do you have? And do you need to bring it to us? And of course, the ongoing discussions between journalists and editors and media houses to say, make sure the journalists, your journalists are always well trained. And let's not fall into any of these horrendous traps that some might find themselves in. The last thing we ever want is to deal with a situation of this brown envelope journalism and accusations that media has been bought. That is definitely not the road we want to go down. And if anyone does have information, our lines are always open, and they're welcome to contact us.
Katie Katapodis from the South African National Editors Forum.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the political party Action SA coming out strongly against government's decision to extend the Zimbabwean exemption permits until 2027. The party says the move reflects political indecision, weak governance, and a failure to implement a clear immigration plan. It goes on to argue that repeated extension undermine the rule of law and create uncertainty for both citizens and permit holders. So let's talk a little further about this. I'm in conversation with Action SA Parliamentary Chief Whip Lerato Ngobeni. A very warm welcome to you. It's very easy to criticize, of course. What would you actually do differently tomorrow morning?
You know, your intro is very apt in terms of our stance in this regard. You asked me what we would do. We, in the statement that we released, we spoke about doing a couple of things, and I'm going to mention only three. We are saying, firstly, that there must be regularization for those who meet visa criteria, and these include people who have critical skills in scarce professions, legitimate employment, and family ties. We want this to be fast-tracked. The adjudication process must be fast-tracked, and proper visas must be issued. The second one is that we need those who do not qualify. We speak about, you know, humanity in this regard, the issue of Ubuntu, the issue of human rights. We need a graceful exit for them with assisted voluntary return for those who do not qualify. and we want this to be time-bound, and it must be coordinated with the Zimbabwean government. It's very strange as to what is happening between our government and the Zimbabwean government. It's very unclear, and we need clarity and certainty in this regard. And thirdly, we believe that there should be special humanitarian cases for those people like learners, children who are in long school schooling in our country, those with chronic medical needs, for targeted waivers. And these must be on a case-by-case basis and not this blanket extensions that we have seen the ministry resort to time and time again.
But you will concede that it's difficult to balance enforcement with basic human rights, as you've suggested.
It is very difficult. However, you know, when you are in government, you are governing for your citizens, and indecision and lack of clarity creates the kinds of tensions that we have seen in this country. It absolutely cannot be correct that it can be left to the Human Rights Commission to go and fight with groups like Operation Dudula and so on. What the people of South Africa need is a government that demonstrates that, firstly, it puts them first. Secondly, that they are attending to the issues that are creating the tensions that we are seeing in our country. This has been a long time coming. We have seen xenophobic attacks happening. You know, the earliest I can remember is 2008. It cannot be allowed. And this ZEP program, Jeremy, was never meant to be a permanent solution to the Zimbabwean crisis. It was meant to be a temporary relief for those who were economic migrants into our country. What we need is a time-bound time frame with milestones as to what is it that we are going to do as South Africa on behalf of the Zimbabwean people. Now, the number that is being cited here of over almost 180,000 holders of this permit, the government right now as we speak does not know how many illegal migrants are in this country, and people are abusing the system. People are abusing the courtesy of the ZEP, and South Africa is not being taken seriously, and South Africans don't feel that they're being taken seriously. And this is why we are against this extension, because it has happened time and time again. I think the first time was about a year ago in December. There was another extension. And so we cannot be having these perpetual extensions. We need proper visas for the people who need it and the people who should rightfully and legally be in South Africa.
But you'll concede that it is a very complicated and complex issue. The minister says the extension is pending consultation and also policy review. Surely time needs to be given in order to reach an equitable solution on this particular issue.
Look, this it comes as a result of the court's ruling that, you know, there should be a process that regularizes. There should be a process of consultation. That is correct. But being lawful should not also be misguided. And while you cite the fact that it is complicated, well, life is complicated. But we must uncomplicate it. We must simplify what needs to happen. And extending the process or extending the permits does not uncomplicate the issue. Actually, it compounds the problems that we are facing. What we are asking is that there must be a time-limited process that is clearly articulated, that is communicated to the people of South Africa, and so that the South African people do not see it as a perpetual extension that does not take into account all of the contemporary realities that we are facing. That cannot be ignored, Jeremy. And we're wanting to say this with the strictest, you know, humane terms possible. This is not about, you know, this flaring up and people using, you know, complicated words that just create confusion in our country, such as xenophobia. This is not that. The law is asking, and the courts are asking, that there must be a proper consultation, there must be regularization, and not just perpetual extensions. And this is what we are asking the ministry to do. Yes, it's complicated. Governing is complicated. If it wasn't complicated, we would have everything would be smooth in our country. But however, we do have laws, and those laws must be implemented, and the regulations must go with the laws so that we can be able to implement what South Africans want to see. This is why we're putting pressure on the department to come out with a clear plan and not just to say that we are going to extend until 2027.
And
that is really what we are asking. And the complications are appreciated, Jeremy, notwithstanding.
And if that clear plan is not forthcoming, what then?
Well, our job is to hold the department to account, and this is why you and I are having this conversation. We will continue to apply pressure, but the department and the government of our time now must then be prepared to take responsibility for what is happening. There's been threats now coming, I'm not sure if you're aware, of the barring of children, of undocumented migrants or undocumented children, from being barred from entering school. What is going to happen in our country? We don't want this kind of chaos. What we want is a little bit of certainty. And that is what we are asking from the department. If the department is not forthcoming, we will continue to apply pressure. We'll continue to communicate on behalf of the South African people. We will continue to write to the minister. We'll continue to speak with yourself. And hopefully that the ministry will also respond. But that is our job. More than that, I can't take the minister by the hand and make him write. But we will continue to apply the necessary pressure for that time bound and the timelines and the regularization and uncertainty for on behalf of the South African people. We will continue to do that.
Lerato Ngobeni, thank you very much indeed. The Parliamentary Chief Whip for Action SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the Home Affairs Minister, Leon Schreiber, has again extended Zimbabwean and Lesotho exemption permits by 18 months, now valid until May the 28th, 2027, if I've read this correctly, claiming, in his word, it's a holding pattern while consultations and policy review continues. Critics, though, are saying it's another dodge and that delays decisive action and it undermines the rule of law as well as perpetuates uncertainty. So let's get the view from the Home Affairs Department. Minister Schreiber, a very warm welcome. You say the extension is pending consultation via the Immigration Advisory Board. Why hasn't that board already completed its work, given the urgency and the years of delay?
Good to be with you again, Jeremy. I think it's important when considering some of these unfounded allegations to just give the full picture of where this comes from. So some of these permits date back 10, 15 years. The ZEP, for example, comes from 2009 originally, and structures like the Immigration Advisory Board was effectively abolished, was never put in place for essentially the past decade. And then you'll recall, I think in 2023, there was a decision by the then Minister of Home Affairs to summarily terminate the Zimbabwe exemption permit. That process went to court, and the Constitutional Court overturned that decision, saying that there needs to be thoroughgoing consultation with affected persons before any kind of long-term decision can be made on the future of the permit. And in the interim, it needs to be extended. You can't just take away those rights from people who clearly do have them. So what I found when I came into office, firstly, is that the Immigration Advisory Board did not exist and had not existed for a decade. And so we have moved to reestablish it. It is in place now. And in fact, it has met and provided initial inputs. It's had a series of meetings on this particular issue where it provides some guidance from the advisory board members. These are independent experts as well as experts from different government departments that come together to advise the minister. And then it also gave advice on the importance of consulting with the stakeholders themselves, the holders of these permits and other people affected by it. So that's the second phase that we are now embarking on. The department putting together that comprehensive consultation plan. But I think the key point I want to make is that it is just preposterous to say that this is something that undermines the rule of law. We are fundamentally rebuilding the rule of law by reestablishing the Immigration Advisory Board, by complying with the Constitutional Court's order. And I find it quite strange because the alternative here would have been somehow to take a decision without complying with the Concord order, and that is the thing that would have violated the rule of law.
Minister, some of your critics are saying it's a perpetual extension, or it appears to be. So how then do you prevent this from becoming a rolling delay with without any final outcome? How do you put pressure on the advisory board to act sooner rather than later here?
Well, the reason it feels that way, Jeremy, is because of the way this process was never properly thought through from the beginning. We have to just be honest about that. This is not something that started yesterday or last year when I came into office. It feels like it's been without a plan for a very long time because it was from the very beginning, it was granting extensive rights to people without properly thinking through what that means for the long-term future. So I think I just want to point out as well that the numbers of people on these permits have actually reduced quite meaningfully over time as people have transitioned to other visa categories as well. And that is work that is going on in a dedicated work stream within the department. So I think the point is you can only measure this administration's work from what we've done since last year. You can't measure us because of the frustration that's gone back to 2009. We need to clean up some of the things that have gone wrong in that particular process. And I think it's clear that we're making very good progress there. As I say, the Immigration Advisory Board is back in place after having been absent for a very long time, and it's populated with really excellent people from across the board. It has provided those initial guidance and views. And really, it's now the 18-month period we have in place now, based on the advice from the Immigration Advisory Board. It gives us the opportunity to now properly consult with permit holders and other affected people, and then we can make a decision. So I think it's a much more structured, much more logical, much more constitutionally sound process than the one which came before. And I think we simply cannot have this conversation without constantly acknowledging the fact that there's a constitutional court ruling on this. It's not for the minister to just make something up. We have to comply with what the court has said, and we will do that.
Notwithstanding, Minister, many permit holders still live in limbo. And what about those whose lives, their jobs, housing, family plans, etc., are now being held hostage by this ongoing uncertainty?
Yes, it really is so suboptimal across the board. And I think it's important to make the point as well that these are people who have complied with the law. They are documented. These are not illegal immigrants who came to South Africa without papers and are breaking South African law in the process. It is people who responded to a decision taken back in 2009 by the South African government to say that we are making available this particular exemption permit. And so that's exactly why the Constitutional Court has taken the view that it has. And I think we need to keep in mind that this, when people try to reject this decision or try to have an issue with it, it actually exposes that their concern is not necessarily with illegal immigration. It seems to be even with legal immigration, with people who have followed the law. So we are very mindful of that in the process. We will not go back to a space where Home Affairs violates the law or violates people's rights or, and as I've said really from the start, politicizes legal decisions in a way that actually damages the Constitution. So that's why we're quite clear on making sure that we try to deal with some of the problems that the holders of these permits are facing, and at the same time look at ways where people who may not have perhaps complied with South African law, who have broken the law since coming in, that we can deal with those people as well. So I always say, we have to be guided by the rule of law, and that we cannot have a simple binary where we just say, everything's bad or we can just turn a blind eye to everything on the other side. We have to actually have that nuanced conversation on the way forward. I'm very confident that the Immigration Advisory Board is an excellent vehicle to help us do that. And now we just need to engage with those very people who have suffered, this uncertainty for a very long time and see, can we find a consensus view on the way forward?
And what do you think that consensus view might look like? And what are your plans in terms of that engagement?
So I think the lesson from the Constitutional Court is that we should not preempt it in any way, Jeremy. So I'm going to be totally open to this process, certainly listening to the advisory board with an open mind, listening to the stakeholders with an open mind, and of course, bringing in the clear legal advice. I think the one thing I do want to emphasize for listeners is I do not, under any circumstances, want Home Affairs to end up back in a space where it gets struck down by the highest court in the land. And I think that's the responsibility we have. We have many problems in this country that are caused by politicians who, run their mouth or preempt things or take populist positions. And then at the end of the day, when the court rules against them, then they end up criticizing the court. We're not going to engage in that cycle. I'm going to respect this process. And I think, frankly, every South African who wants to see the rule of law restored should support that particular process. Because whatever our personal view may be, we have to agree that we have a constitution in this country and we have to rebuild faith in it and we have to restore its credibility. And I think that's the process that we've embarked on now.
Leon Schreiber is the Minister of Home Affairs. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a new report is warning that millions of South Africa's lowest paid workers are being priced out of the digital economy. GemHR says cashiers, guards and cleaners often spend 10 to 20% of their income on data and airtime, with the poorest paying the most. Some charged up to 136 rand a gigabyte because they simply can't afford contracts. The result is more than just high costs. It blocks access to things like payslips, training and I guess even job instructions. So I want to talk to GemHR Chief Executive Officer Simon Ellis, and let's discuss what this means for workers, employers and the wider economy. And Simon, this is an important issue and one, I must be honest with you, surprised me, particularly when I saw that figure of 136 Rand. Let's start with the basics. How did we get to a point where the poorest South Africans are paying the most for data?
Jeremy, thanks for having me. I mean, the poorer you are, the more you pay for data. If you don't have credit access or you're deemed credit impaired, you can't take out a contract. And contract airtime is significantly cheaper than prepaid airtime. As a very quick example, 1 gigabyte of prepaid airtime costs 85 Rand, but 5 gigabytes of contract airtime costs 200 Rand. So there's a significant difference. And because deskless workers don't have access to credit, they can't get access to contract airtime.
So is this a regulatory failure? Is it a pricing, a deliberate pricing strategy by the networks? Or is there something deeper here, maybe a structural inequality issue?
It is a structural inequality. I don't know about regulation, but what I do know is what we're seeing on the ground. And that is that deskless workers are paying 10 to 20% of their gross income towards just getting access to connectivity. And I think that's a massive problem.
So can you explain to me in a little more detail what the real world consequences are when someone cannot afford the data to get vital information? And what have you seen in your experience?
Well, I mean, poor connectivity means misshift. It means poor engagement. It means people don't know where they need to be and when they need to be there. It means the frontline workers or the deskless workers that make up 75% of South Africa's economy are disconnected from the workplace. It also means that businesses that are looking to digitize are struggling to digitize because you can't digitize if your employees are disconnected. So we see it on the ground, and it's actually affecting the productivity of our workplace in a really bad way.
So telecom operators might argue that prepaid bundles are flexible and that they would meet consumer needs. Is it your suggestion that they're being exploitative?
I'm not sure they're being exploitative, but what I am saying is there are better ways to give deskless workers access to contract airtime. And one of those ways is through a company like GEM, which is what we do. We give employers the ability to give their employees contract airtime. And that, because we take on the credit risk, it lowers the barrier for those employees to get access to cheaper airtime. Now, unfortunately, the telcos don't have access or don't have the ability to give employees contract airtime because people are credit impaired. But I think if employers recognize that there is an opportunity to do good for their workforce at no cost to them, they should at least consider it.
All well and good. So a call to employers to step in. But Simon, realistically, though, how many are willing or able to subsidize data for staff? Guarantee if I took a straw poll on that, there would be a degree of hesitation.
Absolutely. And that what we're not saying is that you should subsidize this for staff. What we are saying is that if you give your staff access to something like GEM, you can provide contract data to them at no cost to you, so no subsidies, and give your employees the option to take out contracts because we're doing it through a payroll deduction. So as a good example, instead of buying 1 gig of data 5 times in a month, which would cost you circa 450 Rand, you can actually provide them with 5 gigs of data on a contract basis through GEM at less than 200 Rand. A significant saving for the deskless worker on the ground.
I acknowledge that you have a solution, and I do respect that. But I also wonder, as you outline that to me, what role the state might be playing here. Is it new policy reform? I've used the word subsidy already, but should the state be looking at data subsidy? Or maybe there just needs to be more aggressive competition enforcement?
It's a great question. I think one of the things we can do is figure out ways, or the state should figure out ways to ensure that we increase credit access. So A, make sure that digital identity and credit records correspond, and then make sure that we are figuring out ways to give employees access to better credits and access to better rates. I think that comes with the regulatory bodies working with the telcos, but it also applies outside of telcos. And I think ultimately, you know, fundamentally, if you go down to it, the poor are paying more for the same services that the wealthy are paying for. And we need to figure out a way to solve for that.
Simon, let me throw this on the table. Do you think that access to affordable data should be treated as an essential service? And I'm thinking along the lines of maybe water or even electricity.
I'm not sure it's the state's responsibility to make it an essential service, but it is as high up as a basic need there is. We should make access affordable, and there should be ways in which it is created affordable. I don't think it should be deemed an essential service.
Do you think that digital inclusion now, as far as corporate South Africa is concerned, is become or could become a moral obligation or even a bottom line advantage?
I think it's an imperative. If your workforce isn't digitally included, if you aren't moving digital, I think you not only are going to spend more money, but you're going to get left behind. And ultimately, I think you're going to be disrupted by others who are.
And Simon, just in conclusion, educate me a little bit. To what extent is this particular issue on the broader societal radar screen? Is it something that, and you're obviously much closer to this than I am, is this something that is occupying conversation within trade unions, perhaps within corporate South Africa? Is there a degree of disgruntlement around it?
There is. And I think people are recognizing that access is super important. Giving access to those who need it is even more important. We are slowly working out that the financial system that has been created over many years doesn't actually suit the very people who need it. And it's if you're sitting in a boardroom or you're sitting at a government in a government conversation, you are starting to recognize that if we want to uplift the whole of society, we need to give people and employees better access to financial services that actually help them live better lives. So I think it's becoming incredibly important. Getting it right, very difficult.
Simon Ellis, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer at GEM HR. And that's where I want to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.